Why, greetings, my dear traveler. I see my sweet pet Larry has guided you right to where you need to be. Oh, where are you, you ask? This is the Morbid Forest. Come, sit by the fire for a while and let Ranger Harper regale you with a tale to truly terrify. The Morbid Forest is a horror fiction anthology podcast. New episodes release every Tuesday on your favorite podcast streaming app. So, stay close to the ranger, or you'll find yourself trapped within the Morbid Forest.
Darkcast Network. Welcome to the dark side of podcasting.
Abgenommen, bedauert.
And thank you all for tuning in.
And welcome to our week-long anniversary celebration. Where I'll be playing new volumes of the shows that were on in the early days of this podcast. Not only that, but throughout the week, I'll also be answering some of the questions that you guys have sent me. To keep the intro short, I decided to break up the questions, and I'll answer them throughout the week. Now, before we start all that, if you enjoy this podcast, then please follow it, review it if you can, and rate it. Those are all easy things to do, and help out the podcast greatly. And better yet, once you do it once, you're done. You don't have to do it for every episode. Now, on to the questions. I've gotten a few of them that have asked me if there have been any episodes that I couldn't use, or that I couldn't upload. And the answer is yes, and it all comes down to sound quality. Now, I've actually gotten a few questions that have to do with the sound quality or sound in general, so I'm just going to group all of those questions into one. So like I said, there have been some episodes that I just can't use because of how bad the sound is. I try to air every episode that I can, regardless of any kind of static, occasional muffling, but sometimes it's just too much. Now, that is to be expected. Some of these recordings are 60, 70, 80 years old. So the fact that majority of them are still good quality is amazing. What sucks is when a whole series is just too damaged to use. And unfortunately, I've come across that a few times. And still, sometimes I'll find some that sound like they were just made. I personally don't mind the occasional static. It's kind of the charm of OTR. We'll continue the questions in the next episode. In the meantime, don't forget to check out the descriptions for all of my links. If you're on Spotify, check out the polls so I can get feedback about the show. And go ahead and leave a comment too. Let me know what the first OTR or audio drama that you heard was. And now,
please enjoy the show.
Welcome to a half hour of Mind Webs. Short stories from the worlds of speculative fiction.
This is Michael Hansen.
This half hour, our story comes from Thrilling Wonder Stories, copyright 1948 by Standard Magazines Incorporated. It's John D. McDonald's A Child is Crying. His mother, who was brought to New York with him, said at the press conference that Billy was a very bright boy, and there wasn't anything else his parents could teach him. The schoolteacher back in New Mexico shuddered delicately, looking at the distant stars, and said it seemed to her as if everywhere she went and everything she did, she could feel those eyes of Billy's watching her. Bain, the notorious pseudo-psychiatrist, wrote an article loaded with cliches in which he said that the child obviously is a mutation. It remains to be seen whether or not his peculiar talents are inheritable. He mentioned the proximity of Billy's birthplace to atomic experimentation. Emmanuel Gardenstein was enticed out of his New Jersey study, where he was putting on paper his newest theories in symbolic logic and mathematical physics. Gardenstein spent 5 hours in a locked room with Billy. At the end of the interview, Gardenstein emerged biting his thin lips. He returned to New Jersey, locked his house, and took a job as a section hand repairing track on the Pennsy Railroad. He refused to make a statement to the press. John Fulmer spent 4 days getting permission to go 90 feet down the corridor of the Pentagon building to talk to a man who was entitled to wear 5 stars on his uniform. The general said,
"Sit down, Fulmer. All this is slightly irregular."
Fulmer replied, "Well, it's an irregular situation. I couldn't trust Garrity and Hoskins to relay my idea to you in its original form." The little, lean man behind the mammoth desk licked his lips slowly.
"You mean to suggest that my subordinates are either stupid or self-seeking?"
Fulmer grinned at the little gray man.
Sir, suppose you let me tell you what I'm thinking, and after you have the story, then you can assess any blame you feel is due."
"All right, go ahead." "You may have read about Billy Massner, General."
"Read about him? I've read about him, all right. Listened to newscasts about him, watched his monstrous little face in the newsreels. The devil with him. A confounded freak."
"But is he?" Fulmer queried, his eyes fixed on the general's face.
"What do you mean, Fulmer? Get to the point."
"Certainly, sir. It is of no interest to you or to me, General, to determine the reason for the kid's talents. What do we know about those talents?" "Just this. The kid could read and write and carry on a conversation when he was 13 months old. At 2 and a half, he was doing quadratic equations. At 4, completely on his own, he worked out theories regarding non-Euclidean geometry and theories of relativity that parallel the work of Einstein. Now he's 7. You read the Beach report after the psychologists got through with him. He can carry on a conversation on mathematical concepts right on over the heads of our best men who have given their life to such things. The thing that happened to Gardenstein's an example. The Beach report states that William Massner, age 7, is the most completely rational being ever tested. The fact of imagination is so small as not to respond to any known test. The kid gets his results by taking known and observed data and extrapolating from that point, proving his theories by exhaustive cross-checks."
"Well, so what, Fulmer, so what?"
"What is our weapon of war, General? The top weapon?"
The atom bomb, of course."
"And the atom bomb was made possible by the work of physicists in the realm of pure theory. The men who made the first bomb compared to Billy Massner the way you and I compare to those men."
"What are you getting at?"
"Just this, General. Billy Massner is a national resource. He's our primary weapon of offense and defense. As soon as our enemy realize what we have in this kid, I have a hunch they'll have him killed. Inside that head of his is our success in the war that's coming up one of these days." The general placed his small, hard palm on a yellow pencil and rolled it back and forth on the surface of his huge desk. The wrinkles between his eyebrows deepened, and he said gently, "Vollmer, I'm sort of out of my depth on this atomic business. To me, it's just a new explosive, more effective than those in use up to this time. And it will be continually improved. You know what a very small portion of the available energy is released right now. Well, General, I'll bet you this kid can point out the way to release all the potential energy." "Why haven't you talked this over with a head physicist?" "Oh, but I have. He sneered at the kid first. I managed to get him an interview with Billy. Now he's on my side. He's too impressed to be envious. The kid fed him a production shortcut. What do we have to do?" "I've talked to the boy's mother, and last week I flew out and saw the father. They only pretend to love the kid. He isn't exactly the sort of person you can love. They'll be willing to let me adopt him. They'll sign him over. It'll cost enough dough out of the special fund to give them a life income of $1,000 a month."
"Oh, and then what?"
"The kid is rational. I explain to him what we want, and if he does what we want him to do, well, then he gets anything in the world he wants. It's simple." The general straightened his shoulders.
"Oh, all right, Fulmer. Get underway. Make sure this monster of yours is protected until we can get him behind wire."
"I took the liberty of putting a guard on him, sir."
Good work. I'll be available to iron out any trouble you might run into. And I'll have a copy disc of this conversation cut for your file."
In spite of the general's choice of words, William Massner was not a monster. He was slightly smaller than average for his age, fine-boned and with dark hair and fair skin. His knuckles had the usual grubby childhood look about them. At casual glance, he seemed a normal, decent-looking youngster. The difference was in the absolute immobility of his face. His eyes were gray and level. He had never been known since the age of 6 months to show fear, anger, surprise, or joy. After the brief 10 minutes in court, John Fulmer brought Billy Massner to his hotel room. Fulmer sat on the bed, and Billy sat on a chair by the windows. John Fulmer was a slightly florid man of 30 with pale, thinning hair and a soft bulge at the waistline. His hands were pink and well-kept. Though he had conducted all manner of odd negotiations with the confidence of an imaginative and thoroughgoing bureaucrat, the quiet, gray-eyed child gave Fulmer a feeling of awe. And he said,
"Well, tell me, are you disappointed in your parents for signing you away?"
"I made them uncomfortable. Their affection was a pretense. It was an obvious move for them to trade me for financial security."
Fulmer tried to smile warmly.
"Well, Bill, at least the sideshow's over. We've gotten you away from all the publicity agents. You must have been getting pretty sick of all that."
"If you hadn't stopped it, I would have."
How would you do that?"
"I have observed average children. I would become an average child. They would no longer be interested."
"You mean you could fake possessing their mentality?"
"It would not be difficult. At the present time, I'm faking an intelligence level as much lower than my true level, as the deviation between a normal child and the level I am faking."
Fulmer uncomfortably avoided the level gray eyes, and he said,
"Well, admit you're pretty unusual, Bill. All the head doctors have been trying to find out why and how, but nobody has ever asked you for your opinion. Why are you such a deviation from the norm, Bill?"
The boy looked at him for several motionless seconds.
"There is nothing to be gained by giving you that information, Fulmer."
Fulmer stood up and walked over to the boy. He glared down at him, his arm half lifted.
"Don't get snippy with me, you little freak."
The level gray eyes met his.
Fulmer took 3 jerky steps backward and sat down awkwardly on the bed. How did you do that?
I suggested it to you.
But
I could just as well have suggested that you open the window and step out. We're on the 21st floor.
Well, then why didn't you?
I don't like unnecessary effort. I have made a series of time rhythm extrapolations, even though you are an unimportant man. Your death now would upset the rhythm, changing the end result. With your death, I would be forced to isolate once again all variables and reestablish the new time rhythm to determine one segment of the future.
You can tell what will happen in the future?
Of course. A variation of the statement that the end pre-exists in the means. The future pre-exists in the present with all variables subject to their own cyclical rhythm.
And my going out the window would change the future?
One segment of it.
Do you know when I'm supposed to die?
If I tell you, the fact of your knowledge will make as serious an upset in time rhythm as the fact of your stepping out the window. Your probable future actions would be conditioned by your knowledge.
Oh, you're hedging, Billy. You don't know the future.
You called me up here to tell me that we are taking a plane today or tomorrow to a secret research laboratory in Texas. We will take that plane. In Texas, the laboratory will set up a morning conference system whereby each staff member will bring current research problems to a roundtable meeting. I will answer the questions they put to me. No more than that. I will not indicate any original line of research, even though I will be asked to do so.
And why not?
For the same reason that you are not now dead on the pavement 200 feet below that window. Any interference with time rhythm means laborious recalculations, since by a process of extrapolation, I can determine the future. My efforts would be conditioned by my knowledge of that future.
You mean you couldn't foresee military attacks?
Of course.
Do you know of any?
I do.
You will advise us of them so we can prepare so that we can strike first.
I will not.
Fulmer took William Massner to Texas. They landed at San Antonio, where an Army light plane took them 100 miles northwest to the underground laboratories of the government, where able men kept to themselves from thinking of the probable results of their work. They were keen and sensitive men, the best that the civilized world had yet produced, but they worked with death, with the musty odor of the grave like a gentle touch against their lips. And they didn't stop to think. It was impossible to think of consequences. Think of the job at hand. Think of CM. Think in terms of unbelievable temperatures, of the grotesque silhouette of a man baked into the asphalt of Hiroshima. Billy was given a private suite, his needs attended to by 2 whack corporals who had been given extensive security checks. The 2 women were frightened of the small boy. They were frightened because he spent 1 full hour each day doing a series of odd physical exercises which he had worked out for himself. But that didn't frighten them as much as the fact that during the rest of his free time, Billy sat absolutely motionless in a chair, his eyes half closed, gazing at a blank wall a few feet in front of him. At times he seemed to be watching something, some image, against the flat, white wall. Fulmer was unable to sleep. He didn't eat properly. He had told no one of his talk with Billy at the New York hotel. His knowledge ate at him, as his cheeks sagged and turned sallow, as his plump body seemed to wither. The fear in his eyes became deeper and more set. The research staff made more progress during the first month of roundtable meetings than they had during the entire previous year. The younger men went about with an air of excitement thinly covered by a rigid control. The older men seemed to sink more deeply into fortified battlements of the mind. William Massner's slow and deliberate answers to involved questions resulted in the scrapping of 2 complete lines of research and a tremendous spurt of progress in other lines. Fulmer could not forget the attack which Billy had spoken of and moreover could not forget the fact that Billy knew when the attack would occur. As Fulmer lay rigid and unsleeping during the long hours of night, he felt that the silver snouts of mighty rockets were screaming through the stratosphere, arching and falling toward him, reaching out to explode each separate molecule of his body into a hot whiteness. On the 23rd of October, after William Massner had been at the research center for almost 7 weeks, Fulmer, made bold by stiff drinks, sought out Burton Jenks, the security control officer. They went together to a small, soundproof storeroom and closed the door behind them. Jenks was a slim, tanned man with pale, milky eyes, dry brown hair, and muscular hands. He listened to Fulmer's story without any change in expression. When Fulmer had finished, Jenks said,
"I'm turning you over to Robertson for a psycho."
"Oh, don't be a fool, Bert. Give me a chance to prove it first."
"Prove that nonsense? How?"
"Will you grant that if any part of my story is true, all of it is true?"
"Oh, sure."
"Then do this one thing, Bert. The kid will be coming out of conference in about 10 minutes. He'll go along the big corridor and take the elevator up to his apartment level. Meet him in the corridor. Walk up to him and pretend that you're going to slap him. Your guards will be with you. You're the only man who could try such a thing and get away with it." Jenks stretched lazily.
"I'd enjoy batting the little jerk's ears back. Maybe I won't pretend."
10 minutes later, Jenks stood beside Fulmer. They leaned against the wall of the corridor. The door at the end opened, and Billy came out, closely followed by the two young guards who were always with him whenever he was out of his apartment. Billy walked slowly and steadily, no expression on his small boy face, no glint of light in his ancient gray eyes. Jenks said,
"There goes,"
and walked out to intercept them. He nodded at the guards, drew one hand back as though to strike the boy. For a second, Jenks stood motionless. Then he went backward with odd wooden steps, his back slamming against the corridor wall with a force that nearly knocked him off his feet. Billy stared at him for a moment without expression before continuing toward his apartment. The two guards stood with their mouths open, staring at Jenks, and then hurried to their proper position a few feet behind William Massner. Jenks was pale. He looked toward the small figure of Billy, turned to Fulmer, and said,
"Come on. We'll report to W.W. Gates."
Gates was an unhappy man. He had been a reasonably competent physicist, blessed with a charming personality and an ability to handle administrative details. As a consequence, he was no longer permitted to do research, but had become the buffer between the military and the research staff. His nominal position was head of research, but his time was spent on reports in quadruplicate and in soothing the battered sensibilities of the research staff. Gates loved his profession and continually told himself that he was helping it more by staying out of it. His rationalization didn't make him feel any better. He looked like a bald John L. Lewis without the eyebrows and without the voice. Gates talked in a plaintive squeak. He sat very still and listened while Fulmer told the complete story and Jenks substantiated it. Little beads of sweat appeared on the upper lip of Gates in spite of the air conditioning, and he said slowly,
"If I had never sat in on the conferences, I wouldn't believe it. Science has believed that the future is the result of an infinite progression of possibilities and probabilities with a factor of complete randomness. If you quoted him properly, Fulmer, this time rhythm he spoke of indicates some kind of pattern in the randomness, so that if you can isolate all the possibilities and probabilities and determine the past rhythm, you can extend that pattern. It's sort of a statistical approach to metaphysics and quite beyond our current science. I wish you hadn't told me."
"I've got an idea, sir," Fulmer said, and both men looked at him. "I've spent a long time watching the kid. This reading the future's okay for big stuff, but little things fool him. Once he stumbled and fell against a door. Another time, one of the men accidentally tramped on his foot and it hurt the kid."
"What does that mean?"
asked Jenks. "Well, it means that the kid can avoid big stuff if he wants to, but not minor accidents. I don't think we can carry this much further. The three of us right here are carrying the ball. It's up to us." The future's locked up in the kid's mind. Now, here's what we do. Corporal Alice Dentro was nervous. She knew that she had to forget her personal fears and carry out her orders. An order was an order, wasn't it? She was in the army, wasn't she? After all, her superiors must know what they're doing. She aimlessly dusted the furniture and glanced toward the chair where William Massner sat motionless, staring at a blank wall. Her lips were tight, and little droplets of cold sweat trickled down her body. She moved constantly closer to the boy. 5 feet from him, she reached into her blouse pocket and pulled out the hypodermic. It slid easily out of the aseptic plastic case. Quickly, she held it up to the light, depressed the plunger until a drop of the clear liquid appeared at the needle tip. A few feet closer. Now she could reach out and touch him. He didn't move. She held herself very still, the needle poised. A quick thrust. The boy jumped as the needle slid through the fabric of his sleeve and penetrated the smooth skin. She pushed the plunger before he twisted away. She backed across the room, dropping the hypodermic. It glistened against the thick pile of the rug. She stood with her back against the door. Billy tried to stand, but slumped back. In a few seconds, his chin dropped on his chest, and he began to snore softly. She glanced at her watch. With a trembling hand, she unlocked the door. Gates, Jenks, and Fulmer came in quickly and quietly. With them was Dr. Badlow of the infirmary. He carried a small black case. Jenks nodded at Alice Dentro. She slipped out into the corridor and walked quickly away, her shoulders squared. Behind her, she heard the click of the lock on the steel door. As the results of the first drug went away, Billy was given small increments of a derivative of scopolamine. They had turned his chair around, loosened his clothing. Only one light shone in the apartment. It was directed at his face. Dr. Badlow sat near him, fingers on the boy's pulse. Jenks, Gates, and Fulmer stood just outside the circle of light. Badlow said,
"He's ready now. Just one of you ask the questions."
Both Jenks and Fulmer looked at Gates. He nodded. In his thin, high voice, Gates said,
Billy, is it true that you can read the future?
Yes, not every aspect of the future, merely those segments of which interest me. Method is subject to a standard margin of error.
Can you explain that margin of error?
Yes. One segment of the future concerns my relationship with the organization. My study of the future indicated that Fulmer, knowing my ability to read the future, would interest others and that a successful attempt would be made to render me powerless and keep my readings to myself.
The three men stared at each other in sudden shock, and Gates, with a quaver in his voice, said,
Then you knew that we would do this thing?
Yes.
Why didn't you anticipate it and avoid it?
To do so would have been to alter the future.
Are you a mutation caused by atomic radiation?
No.
What are you?
A direct evolutionary product. There are precedents in history. The man who devised the bow and arrow is a case in point. He was necessary to humanity because otherwise humanity would not have survived. He was more capable than his fellows.
Are we to assume, then, that your existence is necessary to the survival of humanity?
Yes. The factor missing from man's intellect is the ability to read the future. To do so requires a more lucid mind than has hitherto existed. The use of atomic energy makes a knowledge of the future indispensable to survival. The evolution has provided humanity with a new species of man, able to anticipate the results of its own actions.
Will we be attacked?
Of course, and you will counterattack again and again. As a result of this plan of yours, you hope to be able to attack first, but your military won't credit my ability to see into the future.
When will the attack come?
No less than 40, not more than 52 days from today. Minor variables that cannot be properly estimated give that margin of error.
Who will win?
Win? There will be no victory. That is the essential point. In the past, the wars between city-states ceased because the city-states became too small a social units in a shrinking world. Today, a country is too small a social unit. This war will be the terminal point for inter-country warfare, as it will dissolve all financial, linguistic, and religious barriers.
So, what will the population of the world be when this war is over?
Between 50 and 150 million. There will be an additional 50% shrinkage due to disease before population begins to climb again.
There was silence in the darkened room. The boy sat motionless, awaiting the next query. Dr. Badlow had taken his fingers from the boy's pulse and sat with his face in his hands, and Gates said slowly,
I don't understand. You spoke as though your type of individual has come into the world as an evolutionary answer to atomics. If this war will happen, in what sense are you saving mankind?
My influence is zero at this point. I will be ready when the war is over. I will survive it, because I can anticipate the precautions to be taken. After it is over, the ability to read the future will keep mankind from branching off to its repetition of militarism and fear. I have no part in this conflict.
But you have improved our techniques.
I have increased your ability to destroy. Were I to increase further, you would have been able to make the Earth completely uninhabitable.
Then your work is through?
Of course. The result of the drug you have administered to me will be to impair the use of my intellect. I will be sent away. My abilities will return in sufficient time to enable me to survive.
Gates' voice became a whisper.
Are there others like you?
I estimate that there are at least 20 in the world today. Of course, many have managed to conceal their gifts. The older should be not more than 9. They are scattered all over the earth. They all have an excellent chance of survival. 30 years from now, there will be more than 1,000 of us.
Gates glanced over at Jenks, saw the fear and the obvious question. Fulmer had the same expression on his face. With a voice that had in it a small touch of madness, Gates said,
What is the future of those of us in this room? Will we survive?
I have not explored the related probabilities. I knew in New York that it was necessary for Fulmer to survive to bring me here and to tell you of my abilities. It can be calculated.
Now?
Give me 30 seconds.
Again, the room was silent. Badlow had lifted his face, his eyes naked with fear. Jenks shifted uneasily. Fulmer stood, barely breathing. Gates twisted his fingers together. The seconds ticked by. 4 men waited for the word of death or life. Billy Massner licked his lips.
Not one of you will live more than 3 months from this date.
He's crazy.
They wanted to believe Jenks. They had to believe the boy. Gates whispered.
How will we die?
They watched the small boy face. Slowly, the impassivity of it melted away. The gray eyes opened, and they were not the dead gray eyes the men had grown accustomed to. They were the frightened eyes of boyhood. There was fear on the small face, fear and indecision. The voice had lost its flat and deadly calm.
Who are you?
The boy asked, close to tears.
What do you want? What are you doing to me? I want to go home.
In the darkened room, four men stood and watched a small boy cry. You've heard A Child is Crying by John D. MacDonald. From Thrilling Wonder Stories, copyright 1948 by Standard Magazines. This is Michael Hansen. Reading with me was Stephen Elliott Hansen. Technical operation for this program by Marcia Phillips. MindWebs is a production of WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension. This is Michael Hansen. The story this half hour is The Foghorn by Ray Bradbury, copyright 1951 by the Curtis Publishing Company. It's a lonely life, but you're used to it now, aren't you? Asked McDunn. Yes, I said. Yes, you're a good talker, thank the Lord. Well, it's your turn on land tomorrow. Your turn to dance the ladies and drink gin. What do you think, McDunn? What do you think when I leave you out here alone? On the mysteries of the sea. McDunn lit his pipe. It was a quarter past seven of a cold November evening. The heat on, the light switching its tail in 200 directions, the fog horn bumbling in the high throat of the tower. There wasn't a town for 100 miles down the coast, just a road which came lonely through dead country to the sea with few cars on it, a stretch of 2 miles of cold water out to our rock and rare few ships. I think about the mysteries of the sea. You know, the ocean's the biggest damn snowflake ever. It rolls and swells a thousand shapes and colors, no two alike. Strange. One night years ago, I was here alone, when all of the fish of the sea surfaced out there. Something made them swim in and lie in the bay, sort of trembling and staring up at the tower light going red, white across them so I could see their funny eyes. I turned cold. They were like a big peacock's tail moving out there until midnight. And then, without so much as a sound, they slipped away. The million of them was gone. I kind of think maybe in some sort of way they came all those miles to worship. Strange.
But think how the tower must look to them, standing 70 feet above the water, the godlight flashing out from it, and the tower declaring itself with a monster voice. They never came back, those fish. But don't you think for a while they thought they were in the presence?
I shivered, and I looked out at the long gray lawn of the sea stretching away into nothing and nowhere.
Oh, the sea's full.
McDunn puffed his pipe nervously, blinking. He had been nervous all day and hadn't said why.
For all our engines and so-called submarines, it'll be 10,000 centuries before we set foot on the real bottom of the sunken lands, in the fairy kingdoms there, and no real terror. Now think of it. It's still the year 300,000 before Christ down under there, while we've paraded around with trumpets lopping off each other's countries and heads. They've been living beneath the sea 12 miles deep and cold in a time as old as the beard of a comet. Yes, it's an old world, all right. Come on, I got something special I've been saving up to tell you.
We ascended the 80 steps, talking and taking our time. At the top, McDunn switched off the room light so there'd be no reflection in the plate glass. The great eye of the light was humming, turning easily in its oiled socket. The foghorn was blowing steadily once every 15 seconds.
Sounds like an animal, don't it? A big, lonely animal crying in the night, sitting here on the edge of 10 billion years, calling out to the deeps, I'm here, I'm here, I'm here. And the deeps do answer. Yes, they do. You've been here now for 3 months, Johnny, so I better prepare you. About this time of year, something comes to visit the lighthouse.
And he studied the murk and fog. The swarms of fish, like you said, McDunn?
No, this is something else. I've put off telling you because you might think I'm daft. But tonight's the latest I can put it off, for if my calendar's marked right from last year, tonight's the night it comes. I won't go into detail. You'll have to see it for yourself. Just sit down there. If you want, tomorrow you can pack your duffel and take the motorboat into land and get your car parked there at the dinghy pier on the Cape and drive on back to some little inland town and keep your lights burning nights. I won't question or blame you. It's happened 3 years now, and this is the only time anyone's been here with me to verify it. You wait and watch.
Half an hour passed with only a few whispers between us. When we grew tired of waiting, McDunn began describing some of his ideas to me. He had some theories on the foghorn itself.
One day, many years ago, a man walked along and stood in the sound of the ocean on a cold, sunless shore and said, "We need a voice to call across the water to warn ships. I'll make one. I'll make a voice like all of time and all of the fog that ever was. I'll make a voice that is like an empty bed beside you all night long, and like an empty house when you open the door, and like trees in autumn with no leaves. A sound like the birds flying south crying, and a sound like November wind and the sea and the hard, cold shore. I'll make a sound that's so alone that no one can miss it, that whoever hears it will weep in their souls, and hearths will seem warmer, and being inside will seem better to all who hear it in the distant towns. I'll make me a sound and an apparatus, and they'll call it a foghorn, and whoever hears it will know the sadness of eternity and the briefness of life."
The foghorn blew.
I made up that story. to try to explain why this thing keeps coming back to the lighthouse every year. The foghorn calls it, I think, and it comes. But there. And McDunn nodded out to the deeps. Something was swimming toward the lighthouse tower. It was a cold night, as I've said. The high tower was cold, the light coming and going, and the foghorn calling and calling through the rattling mist. You couldn't see far, and you couldn't see plain, but there was the deep sea moving on its way about the night earth, flat and quiet, the color of gray mud. And here were the two of us alone in the high tower, and there, far out at first, was a ripple, followed by a wave, a rising, a bubble, a bit of froth. And then from the surface of the cold sea came a head, a large head, dark-colored with immense eyes, and then a neck, and then not a body, but more neck and more. The head rose a full 40 feet above the water on a slender and beautiful dark neck. Only then did the body, like a little island of black coral and shells and crayfish, drip up from the subterranean. There was a flicker of tail. In all, from head to tip of tail, I estimated the monster at 90 or 100 feet. I don't know what I said. I said something. McDunn whispered, "Steady, boy, steady. It's impossible." "No, Johnny, we're impossible. It's like it always was 10 million years ago. It hasn't changed. It's us and the land that have changed, become impossible. Us." It swam slowly and with a great dark majesty out in the icy waters far away. The fog came and went about it momentarily, erasing its shape. One of the monster eyes caught and held and flashed back our immense light, red, white, like a disc held high and sending a message in primeval code. It was as silent as the fog through which it swam. I crouched down, holding to the stair rail. "It's a dinosaur of some sort." "Yes, one of the tribe."
"But they died out."
"No, only hid away in the deeps. Deep, deep down in the deepest deeps. Isn't that a word now, Johnny? A real word. It says so much. The deeps. There's all the coldness and darkness and deepness in a word like that."
"What do we do?"
"Do? We've got our job and we can't leave. Besides, we're safer here than in any boat trying to get to land. That thing's as big as a destroyer and almost as swift."
"But here, why does it come here?" The next moment I had my answer. The foghorn blew, and the monster answered. A cry came across a million years of water and mist. A cry so anguished and alone that it shuddered in my head and my body. The monster cried out at the tower. The foghorn blew. The monster roared again. The foghorn blew. The monster opened its great toothed mouth, and the sound that came from it was the sound of the foghorn itself. Lonely and vast and far away. The sound of isolation, a viewless sea, a cold night, apartness. That was the sound.
"Now, do you know why it comes here?"
I nodded.
"All year long, Johnny, that poor monster there lying far out, 1,000 miles at sea and 20 miles deep maybe, biding its time. Perhaps it's 1,000,000 years old, this one creature. Think of it, waiting 1,000,000 years. Could you wait that long? Maybe it's the last of its kind. I sort of think that's true. Anyway, here come men on land and build this lighthouse 5 years ago and set up their foghorn and sound it out toward the place where you bury yourself and sleep and see memories of a world where there were thousands like yourself. But now you're alone, all alone in a world not made for you, a world where you have to hide. But the sound of the foghorn comes and goes, and you stir from the muddy bottom of the deeps, and your eyes open like the lenses of 2-foot cameras, and you move slow, slow, for you have the ocean sea on your shoulders, heavy. But that foghorn comes through 1,000 miles of water, faint and familiar, and the furnace in your belly stokes up, and you begin to rise, slow, slow. You feed yourself on great lakes of cod and minnow and rivers of jellyfish, and you rise slow through the autumn months, through September when the fog started, through October with more fog, and the horn still calling you on. And then, late in November, after pressurizing yourself day by day, a few feet higher every hour, you are near the surface and still alive. You've got to go slow. If you surfaced all at once, you'd explode. So it takes you all of 3 months to surface, and then a number of days to swim through the cold waters to the lighthouse. And there you are, out there in the night, Johnny, the biggest damn monster in creation. And here's the lighthouse calling to you, with a long neck like your neck sticking way up out of the water, and a body like your body, and most important of all, a voice like your voice. Do you understand now, Johnny? Do you understand? The foghorn blew. The monster answered. I saw it all. I knew it all. The million years of waiting alone for someone to come back who never came back. The million years of isolation at the bottom of the sea, the insanity of time there, while the skies cleared of reptile birds, the swamps dried on the continental lands. The sloths and saber-tooths had their day and sank in tar pits, and men ran like white ants upon the hills. The foghorn blew. Last year, that creature swam round and round and round all night. Not coming too near, puzzled, I'd say, afraid, maybe, and a bit angry after coming all this way. But the next day, unexpectedly, the fog lifted, the sun came out fresh, the sky was as blue as a painting, and the monster swam off away from the heat and the silence and didn't come back. I suppose it's been brooding on it for a year now, thinking it over from every which way. The monster was only 100 yards off now, it and the foghorn crying at each other. As the lights hit them, the monster's eyes were fire and ice. That's life for you. Someone always waiting for someone who never comes home. Always someone loving something more than that thing loves them. And after a while, you want to destroy whatever that thing is, so it can't hurt you anymore. The monster was rushing at the lighthouse. The foghorn blew. Let's see what happens. McDonough switched the foghorn off. The ensuing minute of silence was so intense that we could hear our hearts pounding in the glassed area of the tower. Hear the slow, greased turn of the light. The monster stopped and froze. Its great lantern eyes blinked. Its mouth gaped. It gave a sort of rumble like a volcano. It twitched its head this way and that as if to seek the sounds now dwindled off into the fog. It peered at the lighthouse. It rumbled again. Then its eyes caught fire. It reared up, threshed the water, and rushed at the tower, its eyes filled with angry torment. McDonough, switch on the horn! McDonough fumbled with the switch, but even as he flicked it on, the monster was rearing up. I had a glimpse of its gigantic paws, fish skin glittering in webs between the finger-like projections, clawing at the tower. The huge eye on the right side of its anguished head glittered before me like a cauldron into which I might drop, screaming.
The tower shook. The foghorn cried. The monster cried. It seized the tower and mashed at the glass, which shattered in upon us. McDonald seized my arm. Come downstairs. The tower rocked, trembled, and started to give. The foghorn and the monster roared, and we stumbled and half fell down the stairs. Quick, Johnny! We reached the bottom as the tower buckled down toward us. We ducked under the stairs into the small stone cellar. There were 1,000 concussions as the rocks rained down. The foghorn stopped abruptly. The monster crashed upon the tower. The tower fell. We knelt together, McDonough and I, holding tight, while our world exploded. Then it was over. It was over, and there was nothing but darkness in the wash of the sea on the raw stones. That and the other sound. Listen. Listen. We waited a moment. And then I began to hear it. First a great vacuumed sucking of air, and then the lament, the bewilderment, the loneliness of the great monster folded over and upon us, above us, so that the sickening reek of its body filled the air, stone's thickness away from our cellar. The monster gasped and cried. The tower was gone. The light was gone. The thing that had called to it across a million years was gone. And the monster was opening its mouth and sending out great sounds. The sounds of a foghorn, again and again. And ships far at sea, not finding the light, not seeing anything, but passing and hearing late that night, must have thought, there it is, the lonely sound, the lonesome bay horn, all's well. We've rounded the cape. And so it went for the rest of the night. The sun was hot and yellow the next afternoon when the rescuers came out to dig us from our...
It fell apart, is all. We had a few bad knocks from the waves and it just crumbled.
McDonough pinched my arm. There was nothing to see. The ocean was calm... The sky blew. The only thing was a great algaic stink from the green matter that covered the fallen tower stones and the shore rocks. Flies buzzed about. The ocean washed empty on the shore. The next year, they built a new lighthouse. But by that time, I had a job in a little town and a wife and a good small warm house that glowed yellow on autumn nights. The doors locked, the chimney puffing smoke. As for McDonough, he was master of the new lighthouse, built to his own specifications out of steel-reinforced concrete. Just in case, he said. The new lighthouse was ready in November. I drove down alone one evening, late, and parked my car and looked across the gray waters and listened to the new horn sounding once, twice, three, four times a minute, far out there, by itself. The monster? It never came back.
It's gone away, McDonough said. It's gone away. It's gone back to the deeps. It's learned you can't love anything too much in this world. It's gone into the deepest deeps to wait another million years. Ah, poor thing. Waiting out there while man comes and goes on this pitiful little planet. Waiting and waiting.
I sat in my car, listening. I couldn't see the lighthouse or the light standing out in Lonesome Bay. I could only hear the horn, the horn, the horn. It sounded like the monster calling. I sat there wishing there was something I could say. plays The Foghorn, copyright 1951 by the Curtis Publishing Company. This is Michael Hansen. Technical operation for this program by Bob Chan. MindWebs is a production of WHA Radio in Madison, a service of University of Wisconsin Extension.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.